Accession number 21290, wheel 3.
Colonel Gosling, Rio 3. You were talking about, you said you couldn't understand the French, the Norman civilians.
Well, it was difficult on the attitude. And you see, you had the resistance, the Maquis on the one side. And the Maquis couldn't bear the Germans. Of course, they were fighting and being killed, all the rest of it. Then you had the collaborators. And the collaborators were even bigger enemies of the Maquis than the Germans were. So that was the most difficult thing, and I'm jumping almost a month ahead now, because as we went on through Normandy, you constantly came on that situation. Are you going to come up against a group of collaborators or a group of Maquis? What's it going to be? How do you behave towards these people? And eventually, the French took the view that, you know, the Germans were going to get beaten and they better back the English and the Americans. But it was very fraught in the first sort of month, really. I don't think my imagination is going wrong. It was like that.
Were you in the Falaise Pockets battle?
No, we were just on the fringe of it. It was just further south of it. And we saw it. We went through the edge of it just after the battle. It was a terrible situation, and the smell of dead cattle, of course. Talk about the smell in England of foot and mouth. But that was terrible, because every time you fired an artillery barrage anywhere, Normandy was a cattle country. There were marvellous French cattle all over the place. And they were just killed like flies by English shells. And that's why the French didn't like us very much either. Their pedigree cattle were killed by a lot of our barrages. Yes, we were just through the edge of it, and it was a horrible thing, because the French, the Germans, had horse-drawn artillery, and most of their transport was horse-drawn, and of course they couldn't save them at all, and so there were dead German horses all over the place.
Can you tell me, please, about the breakout from Normandy?
Not really, no. The fighting breakout came from Falaise, and that's where the Poles, and I think the Canadians had come through, and the Americans came through there. And we were in the 8th Armoured Brigade dying. I must have something to drink. Is there an orange? We were on the north side of the breakout, of course, and our next thing was to get to the Seine. And the crossing of the Seine was going to be a very vital thing. And the Americans, by then, they'd captured Paris, and they came up from Paris, and the 11th Armoured were near the coast, and we were in the middle. And we had to get over the Seine, get over the River Seine at a place called Vernon. And it was a place that Germans ought to have held. It had very steep banks to it, and the Germans could have held it very strongly. But for various reasons, we got through. We were in a strong position then. We had all the artillery there, and the English artillery was very good. And so we got over Vernon. We got over Vernon on pontoon bridges, on rafts, on bailey bridges. We got over in all sorts of different ways. And once we got over the River Seine at Vernon, we were clear to go through over the Somme and clear to get through into Belgium. And at that time, it was clear that the Germans, they'd made their decision to evacuate France virtually. And the German generals were very good, and they were concerned of getting their fighting people back to Germany as quick as they could. And they abandoned a lot of their horse stuff and a lot of their half-civilian Germans who were there, and they did a fighting retreat. And we went as fast as we could. We had to get through Brussels, which was a very delayed effect, because the Belgians, who had been very much collaborators with Germans all the time, and when the English and the Americans arrived, the English arrived first in Brussels, because the Belgians went marvellous, and vive les Anglais, and then they kept kissing us and giving us champagne, and we had an awful job to sort of get through, and then we had to fight our way through the edge of Belgium until we got into the edge of Holland. I should have to refer to my book, I think. I've lost the sequence of events, because soon we're in September now, and we're getting near the sort of planning of Market Garden. And at that stage, we knew either we had to stop, and that was going to be the end of the war, or we had to go on fighting right the way through. And we had this marvellous order group by, what was his name? Not Dempsey.
Horrocks?
Horrocks. He gave his marvellous order group in Borg Leopold, I think it was. And he gave them this marvellous fighting talk, rather like Monte before we went over there, how we were going to win the war, but how we had a very big job and we had to go through. And it was going to be one single line through Eindhoven, right the way through to Nijmegen. And then we were going over the bridge at Nijmegen, and we'd go on over the bridge at Arnhem. And then in no time at all, we'd be in Berlin. And he was very enthusiastic, a very nice man. A marvellous talk to the 30 Corps. And we all listened to him absolutely with our ears pinned back. And we shouldn't do it to a general, but everyone clapped him and always said encore. And regular soldiers didn't like that idea. But he gave us like Monty. He gave us most enormous encouragement. But we knew that it was a very, very difficult operation he was asking us to do. And the person we admired more than anyone, we admired Horrocks, we admired Miles Dempsey. He's a picture of him in a, and he was the Second Army commander. And we knew that as long as he was doing it, it would be all right. So we had another D-Day. D-Day was when we had to break out, and we go down there to London. And we were then in Holland.
Did you do any fighting on the Escaut Canal?
At Arnhem.
Escaut Canal? The Escaut Canal?
Yes, we did. I'm trying to picture that. Yes, I don't think I did myself. I think it was only a very narrow front at the Escaut Canal. And I think another battery, my cousin Cecil, you see the Essex Yeomanry were virtually Royal Horse Artillery Regiment, and our job was to support armoured regiments. And so I supported the 4th 7th Dragoons, Cecil supported the 13th 18th, Chris Sidgwick supported the Sherwood Rangers, and those were the three armoured regiments in the 8th Armoured Brigade. Well, an 8th Armoured Brigade is quite a narrow front, but if you get an armoured division, then you have a whole division of artillery, and you have three times the amount of artillery. So there's a lot of artillery other than the Essex Yeomanry. But we were very mobile, and we could be in tanks. I was in a tank all the time. And it meant that if a tank's went in trouble, the FOO would be in a tank with a front tank, and he could bring fire down, local fire, just to support those tanks. And that's what I did all the way through. So we went, after the Escaut Canal, we went on. Where's my book again? That's just...
Well, don't worry about that. Can you tell me about going into Holland, into yes. Nijmegen,
so,
please?
Yeah, we went through Eindhoven, and then we started to get there. And this is where, to me, one of the most interesting parts of the war, because this is where the airborne started to come in. And the American 82nd Airborne, who were first-class troops, whatever I've said about the Americans, I won't say a word about the American 82nd. They were very, very good, except you never saw their officers. But their NCOs and their soldiers were very good. And they had to take a place called Grosbeek, which was on the south side of Nijmegen, to stop a German armoured attack coming in up from the south. And that was the American role. And at the same time, the Guards Armoured were meant to come through down the centre line, and they were supposed to... thank you very much. They were supposed to get the bridge at Arnhem, and the Americans were going to join up. Well, if you read the histories there, the Americans... Are you coming to sit, Danny?
No,
very big-headed. And if you read the history there, it's not like Tony Richardson. The Americans sort of won the war, and they reckoned they got through and everything, but we knew perfectly well what the Guards had done. And so we got to Arnhem, and there was a lot of very heavy fighting at Arnhem, which was just as big fighting as at Nijmegen. We got to Nijmegen, just as big fighting as at Arnhem. But we couldn't get over the river there. And eventually the Guards got over, and the Americans boated over, very brave indeed, had a terrible lot of casualties. They boated over in their little boats, and they joined up with the Guards on the other side. And so there we had a little narrow bridgehead over the River Wall. And at that time, I was up in my tank train, and the whole idea was to join up with the airborne at Arnhem. And it wasn't easy. We were on a narrow front, very narrow front. The Germans had very good defensive thing like that. And the guards couldn't do it. I say nothing against the guards, but it was a very difficult situation. And the Americans were all worn out with their airborne fighting. And they decided not to do it, and just to blame the English for everything. And I was supporting the 47th Dragoons, who had to cross on the railway bridge at Nijmegen and then try to get up to Arnhem or through all the, what they call the, not the area, what's the place, in between Arnhem and Nijmegen.
Bemmel?
Yes, all that area. And so I remember on a tank with the 47th over the railway bridge at Nijmegen, and that was a very frightening thing, because the sleepers were out, and you could look down underneath, you saw this nasty river just down below you. Luckily, the Germans didn't show us too much, and we got over. And as soon as we got over, then you started to come to all the retreating Germans on that bit of ground. And anyway, we got up, myself and my battery, and the 47th Dragoons, up to the Niederrhein. And we got up to the Niederrhein, opposite Oosterbeek. Is that where the airborne ended? Opposite Oosterbeek. And we couldn't get over the Niederrhein either. And the Germans held that very close indeed. And the guards couldn't get on straight on. And there for a minute, the war sort of stalled as far as we were concerned, as far as a lot of people were concerned, because you couldn't get over. You only had a narrow bridge at Nijmegen. You couldn't get up to Arnhem. And the Germans had reinforced Arnhem completely. And so it became, and this was October then, and you were fighting in very difficult sort of Dutch country in between the two. And at that stage, some of us were able to draw back. And I came back over the river, over the River Wall, this is, and we had to hold then the south bank of the River Wall, which was then Marston Well, and this is where I met my wife. And the Germans were still about in odd farms around there, and we were sort of rounding up odd little parties of German and casing them out, and we knew there were some Germans there. And Max Beale and I, we went down to a farm, and we knew there were some Germans there still, but most of the Germans in that part of Holland were running away then. They were running away back to Germany. And Max and I went into this house, and as we went in, Germans sort of emerged from a cell in the kitchen at the back and disappeared. And next thing I saw was my wife came up out of the cellar and her husband and said, "You're the first English people I've seen for 5 years." And we pushed the Germans out. We didn't have to shoot at them because they all ran away. But when I say I liberated my wife, it's quite true. Mm-hmm. I said, "That's." And then years later we married. And I should go back to the war now. And so it became rather sort of static fighting for a bit then, and that was in October, November, 39, October, November, 44. And we knew we couldn't get forward anymore. And the next thing was to go down to the south, to go down to Limburg, and fight down there. And that was a long, tedious trek in our tanks all the way down the road. There were no Germans there, but it was a tiresome thing. We had to get down through Venn there. And eventually we got down to the edge of Germany in Sittard, Sustrum, several little places, little German villages.
Sustrum, in Limburg.
In Limburg, yes. Geilenkirchen was down there. Mm-hmm. And we had a very cold winter over Christmas in 39, because the Germans were quite strong on that side. And it was so muddy and dirty down there, and there was ice as well, and very difficult to get Sherman tanks on the road. And we had a lot of nasty casualties down there. And the Americans were coming up from the south, and we didn't quite know what the Americans were doing. They joined up on the top of the Siegfried Line. And Sherwood Rangers was Stanley Christopherson, and he had to join up with the Americans to push through the Siegfried Line. And Americans didn't like it at all, didn't like the Siegfried Line. And he went through and he said, it's all right, leave it to me. He was a tank officer and he had tanks, and tanks really weren't the right thing to sort of tackle German pillboxes. Americans waited. I mustn't talk against the Americans. Americans waited until the British tanks sort of pushed their way through. And then the Germans did withdraw. And the Americans were able to get through and occupy it. And the German commander, the American commanding officer there, as to the way the Americans work, of course, he said, look, isn't it marvellous? The Germans have withdrawn, and now we can have breakfast. And I tell you what, we'll have peaches and cream for breakfast. Well, we hadn't seen peaches and cream for 5 years. We found it very lucky the Americans to do that. That was Stanley Christopherson. And so then I came back and my battery, and we finished the fighting down there because the Germans had again made a strong line of resistance, and they were on the line of Orion. And we came back into Nijmegen from the other area, and soon we got into a thing called Operation Veritable. And Operation Veritable was very, very heavy fighting in the forest of Reichswald. The Reichswald was a big German forest in between the Rhine and Nijmegen. And again, it was very muddy, it was flooded. The Germans had flooded a lot of things. They were very well dug in there. We were half fighting in Germany. And very nasty, unpleasant fighting, terrible lot of ammunition fired. And we had to work our way through. But we knew at that stage we were going to win the war. We still had to get over the Rhine. And there were still Germans all over the place. And so by then we were just in the edge of Germany too. And we saw the first sort of German houses with German white flags out. We were very nervous when we saw a German white flag because we weren't sure at all that they were going to surrender. Next minute, another flag was down. And there was some nasty little German youth who was shooting at you behind a window. But we got through onto the edge of the Rhine, and we faced up to the Rhine, a place called Ries, R-E-E-S, and Ries and Emmerich. And there we had to do a little repeat of D-Day in a way, and we had to waterproof our tanks again. And Peter Rolls, who was one of my subaltern officers, he had to go over on a leading tank and get over the Rhine. And he ran onto a sandbank quite early on, so he didn't get very far on that. And by then we got a pontoon, I say we, this is the Second Army, got a pontoon bridge over, and then we got some tanks over. And then the Germans started gradually, village by village, Dutch village by Dutch village. And the boundary is very funny in between Germany and Holland there. It goes one thing on Germany, the next minute you're in Holland. So we had to be very careful. We didn't want to knock Dutch houses down unnecessarily, but if they were full of Germans, what could you do? And we worked our way up through over the river at... where are all the little places? Emmen? Is it Emmen? No, I don't think it's Emmen.
Emmerich.
Up to a canal, because eventually I'm going to get you into Hengelo and Elmelo, and that other place with a berg on the end.
Isselberg? Isselburg?
Yes, that's right. All in that area, just on the edge of Germany and Holland. And the Germans, I don't say they'd given up fighting. It's quite untrue. They fought right to the end. But they were much more interested in protecting German houses and German people than they were in protecting the Dutch and fighting the English, as long as they could look after the sort of German side of the frontier there. And at that stage, from my personal point of view, a funny thing happened, because I was still a battery commander. I had a battery commander. We knew which way the war was going. But in Japan, the Japanese were still fighting like anything. And the war office in England was convinced that we'd have the German war would be over soon, and there'd be a major war against Japan. And so we wanted a lot of us to be trained for jungle fighting. And I was sent back to England. It was a terrible waste of time, to do communications in jungle. And all I learned was how to put a rope crossing over some wretched Burmese sort of jungle thing. And luckily, about that stage, the war in Europe came to an end. This is May the 4th, May the 5th. And I finished the war training in Scotland to fight against the Japanese. And apart from the fact that there was a very nice nurse up there, It was a dead loss, sir. And as soon as I could get back, I mean, it was ridiculous because there was my battery still in action at Bremerhaven, and the armistice had just been signed. And so I was able to get back as soon as I could and abandon this idea of going to Japan and fighting the Japanese and take command of my battery again. And we finished, we were in Hanover then. And then we had to be sort of occupation for about 3 or 4 weeks. And at that stage, of course, you had all the concentration camps and all the people coming out and the Russian prisoners. And it was a horrible situation in Germany. We weren't trained for that at all. We were fighting soldiers. And luckily, our colonel was very sensible. And he said, look, the Essex Army battery is a fighting battery. It's not, they're not policemen, they're not soldiers. And we managed to move up towards Kiel. And when we were in Kiel, we started to get ready to think about demobilization. We got a lot of German horses. We taught ourselves to ride, those of us who couldn't ride. We played cricket against the Germans, which we beat them fairly thoroughly. And we were there until Christmas time, 45, where we were demobilized.
What did you think of the performance of your Shermans during the war?
Well, we wouldn't be alive now unless we'd had Shermans, that's quite certain. And I didn't travel in a, what was that enormous great heavy one, not a Covenanter, Churchill. Churchill was a heavy one, and a very awkward thing, and a very cumbersome thing. Shermans were very mobile. Yes, of course, they were nothing like the Germans. Germans had super tanks. No doubt, their Panthers, their Tigers, I mean, were twice as good as any of our tanks. You couldn't get away from it. But our Shermans were very mobile. And we had so many Shermans about to place. If you lost two or three Shermans would come up from the next day. No, I wouldn't like to go to war with a Sherman again, but they saved our lives, a lot of us.
Can you tell me some more details about the way in which a forward observation officer performs his role, please?
The way in which an FOO does what?
Performs his job.
Well, it was the thing I did all through the war, so of course I can. Let me think for a second.
How it's actually done?
Well, first of all, he can't do anything by himself. He's supporting either an infantry unit or another tank unit, and he's directing fire as they require it. I'm not going into a sort of static position, because we were mobile, we were an armored brigade, so we were on the move all the time. And so you're with a tank officer, and you know where your tank officer is going, and you're with your tank officer. But he's going to attack something, or he's got to defend a position, and that he needs artillery fire onto that side. And so you're with him near enough to be able, with him, perhaps talking on the internet, to say, look, we're pretty sure there are German guns behind that farmhouse on that other side of the hill, and we'll fire an Essex Army concentration on that and clear it for you. You can see what's going on. And then after that, we'll come with you for your next step forward, and we'll give you a creeping barrage, but we'll do that. We'll direct the fire, and you tell us where you want it put, and we will give orders to the guns, which we gave orders to the guns, what they were to do and where they were to do it, or we would organize a smoke screen for them. And the FOO has to see where the shells are going to fall. He has to make sure they fall in the right place. He starts on a map reference. He gets corrections from the map reference.
How do you feel now about having served with the Essex Yeomanry in the Second World War?
Oh, it was most wonderful. I mean, I said it's a wonderful time of my life. That's untrue. It's not true. It wasn't like that at all. But I mean, I was terribly lucky because the Essex Yeomanry was a super regiment. They were all people from Essex. They were all friends. Where I was doubly lucky is that the people we supported, the 4th 7th Dragoons, who were a regular regiment, were very nice, gentlemanly collection of people in them. 13th 18th, people like Julius Neave, who was another Yeomanry regiment. Sherwood Rangers, which were the best of the lot, and they were all extremely good people, and they've all remained good friends to us, and we get copies of their regimental journals and things. So it's made a tremendous lot of friends in my life. And the 86th Germany has stayed on because I went after the war to command it. And the first thing I did, of course, was to try to persuade as many of us who fought together to come back again and become territorials. Well, of course, remember, a lot of them had jobs and families and so on. But I soon found myself, I was a second in command quite early on. And because we had a first line regiment which was in the desert, and they had people coming back as well. And there was a man who was senior to me, Colonel George Judd, and he commanded it to start with, and I was his second in command. But then he retired, and then I took command, and I commanded the regiment. It was a wonderful regiment.
Have you had any after effects about having served in the war?
Oh, no, I was... For me, it was a wonderful experience. But of course, when you came back, I came back to become a civilian again. And because I'd been an engineer at Cambridge, and I went back to my old firm. Well, the old firm didn't care very much for people who, you know, came back, said, oh, I was a major in the war, and so on, and so on. And he said, well, you ought to have been an apprentice from working on a machine all through the war. And so it was a very difficult job to go back into one's old job, in the army. In that case, I left my engineering firm, and I became an engineering consultant, which turned out to be a great success for me, in a consulting engineering firm called PE, Production Engineering. And then I found it a plus, because your experience in the war of giving orders and making plans and doing all the rest of it came in very useful in my role in the war and in the civilian life afterwards. And you met various people who'd been in the services who you could talk to, airmen and sailors and so on.
What was the name of your engineering firm?
Production Engineering. That was the name of it. P shortened into PE.
But before that?
Well, before that, you're going back a long way, you see, because I was an apprentice in the Lucas organization, and the Lucas organization was a three-stranded organization of Lucas, Rotex, and CAV. And you move from one to the other. And I moved from Lucas. I did my apprenticeship in Birmingham and Lucas's. And then I went to Rotex in Willesden. And I went to CAV in the edge of London. And at that stage, the war came. So when I came out of the war, I went back into that group. But I found they really had no place for me. No place for me. I'd missed 5 years of it, you see. 5 years of seniority in engineering. And I didn't know anything about civilian engineering very much then, because I'd been quite junior when I left. So I don't regret the army side, but it was a big difference from those people who never went abroad and spent all the time in factories. But we all come with good friends afterwards.